Imagine, just for a moment, the sheer logistical nightmare of what I'm about to describe to you.
Okay.
So you've been tasked with building a multi-million dollar, ultra high-tech industrial oasis.
Right.
We are talking cutting-edge AI, autonomous vehicles, experimental energy grids, but you aren't building this in Silicon Valley or, you know, Shenzhen or Berlin.
No, definitely not.
You are dropping this futuristic city-state into one of the most remote, infrastructure-starved, and frankly, historically volatile regions on the entire planet.
Yeah, which is a massive challenge.
Exactly. Now, put yourself in the shoes of the person whose entire job is to make sure this place doesn't get burned to the ground. How do you protect it?
Well, the historical playbook for that specific problem is it's incredibly predictable.
Fill the wall, right?
Yeah, pretty much. If you look at massive infrastructure projects in remote areas over the last century, whether it's, you know, oil pipelines, diamond mines, or agricultural estates, the knee-jerk reaction is to build a fortress. The project managers look at the environment, perceive it entirely as a threat matrix, and they just start pouring concrete.
Oh, absolutely.
You get high tensile fences, miles of razor wire, blinding floodlights, and a private army of armed guards walking the perimeter, you know, 24 hours a day.
It's the classic us versus them mentality.
Yeah.
Like, keep the expensive stuff inside, keep the perceived threats outside.
Exactly.
It feels like a simple engineering problem.
Yeah.
But the reason we are doing this deep dive today is because the sources we've been poring over propose a completely different, like, frankly, mind-bending approach to that exact problem.
Yeah, it really flips the script.
What if you protected that physical infrastructure, that billion-dollar high-tech oasis, not by building a higher wall, but by giving away free world-class healthcare?
It sounds like a total contradiction, doesn't it?
It really does. It sounds like a joke.
On the surface, it feels like naive philanthropy. But what we are actually going to unpack today is a highly calculated, ruthlessly pragmatic security protocol engineered by a decentralized consortium called D-Reticular.
I am so excited to get into this. We have an incredible stack of internal corporate reports, comprehensive business plans, and some seriously dense technical specifications from this D-Reticular group.
Oh, yeah. The documents are incredibly detailed.
They really are.
Yeah.
And they're running a massive initiative called Project Octagon. And for this deep dive, we are zooming all the way in on a specific site they call Node 1, located in Kabong, Uganda.
Right. Node 1.
And for everyone listening, the core mission of today's deep dive is to understand an operational paradox. We're going to explore how a high-tech clinic in a box, which is essentially just a shipping container packed to the brim with advanced medical AI, manages to generate massive business-to-business profits.
Which is wild in itself.
Yeah. And then we're going to look at how those exact profits are weaponized, not to buy guns, not to build fences,
right,
but to build what they call an impenetrable goodwill moat that secures their entire ecosystem.
So to really grasp the scale of what D-Reticular is attempting here, we need to understand the environment they are operating in.
Okay, set the stage for us.
So Kabong is in the Karamoja subregion of northeastern Uganda. And Node 1 serves as the logistical hub, like the human gateway, for a much larger adjacent project called Node 4.
God.
Node 4 is a staggering 7,000-acre off-grid industrial park. They are running continuous rolling harvests of industrial hemp, and the entire operation is completely self-sufficient.
Wow. 7,000 acres.
Yeah. It runs on what the engineers refer to as island mode.
Meaning they are completely severed from the national power grid or, you know, municipal water supplies.
Yeah.
They're totally on their own.
Entirely on their own. And to power a 7,000-acre industrial park without a grid, they utilize advanced plasma arc gasification microgrids. These are provided by an entity called Agridot Energy.
Okay, let's pause right there, because I know if I hear the phrase plasma arc gasification, my brain immediately goes to sci-fi movies. Like, what is that actually doing on the ground?
It is genuinely fascinating technology. Instead of burning coal or diesel, these microgrids take local agricultural waste, so hemp stalks, local biomass, basically whatever is available.
Use plant trash, essentially.
Exactly, plant trash. And they superheat it to around 1,500 degrees Celsius.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and at that extreme temperature, the waste doesn't just burn. It breaks down at the molecular level into a clean synthetic gas.
Wait, really?
Yeah, and that synthetic gas then generates between 10 to 11 megawatts of clean baseload electricity.
That is wild.
It really is. And they pair this with edge-native AI networks, a system called Rios, to manage the power loads, the autonomous vehicles, the harvesting schedules. It is a technological
Well, it
marvel.
sounds like it.
But the sources highlight a massive glaring vulnerability, and it actually has nothing to do with the technology itself.
Right, the weak point is the human element, the social context.
Exactly. You are dropping a highly exposed, incredibly valuable asset into a region that has been historically characterized by severe developmental neglect, extreme poverty, and, intense resource scarcity.
Okay, so we have the setting. It's a high-tech island in a sea of poverty.
Right.
But before we can even begin to bridge the gap between medical clinic and security system, we have to understand what this clinic is, why it was built in the first place, and how it actually prints money. Because to be clear, this operation is not a charity.
Oh, far from it. It is a highly profitable commercial asset. And the origin of this clinic comes down to solving a very specific operational headache that the planners call the bush gap.
Yeah, I found the bush gap concept so relatable, even just thinking about it from a layman's perspective.
Oh,
Like,
absolutely.
if you were listening to this, imagine you're on a normal vacation, maybe in Mexico or Thailand, and you get severe food poisoning. Even with normal hospitals, a taxi right away, it's terrifying.
Right, it's a nightmare.
Now, magnify that terror. If you were trying to run a Fortune 500 level operation or audit a massive industrial park from what is effectively a desert island, you have a massive human logistics
I
problem.
really do.
You simply cannot expect your VIP investors, your highly specialized tech engineers, or your venture capital auditors to fly out and stay at your facility if a simple mosquito bite means they might, die before they can get a
Yep.
blood test.
Right. And that geographical and infrastructure reality is the defining characteristic of the Karamoja subregion. It creates this bizarre demographic paradox.
How so?
Well, on one hand, Karamoja is surprisingly dense with high-value, highly insured international personnel.
Oh, right, because of all the NGOs and stuff.
Exactly. You have NGO workers from the United Nations, USAI, UNICEF, and Doctors Without Borders managing local relief programs.
Okay.
You have international wildlife conservationists working in the nearby Kadepo Valley National Park. You have corporate engineers auditing international gold mining
That's
operations.
a lot of expats.
And on top of all that, you have ultra-luxury safari tourists paying upwards of $700 a night at remote eco-lodges.
Wow. So literally millions of dollars of human capital just walking around in the bush.
Yep. Yet, despite all that wealth and international presence, there is effectively zero Western standard clinical infrastructure in the immediate region.
So what happens then? Like, if one of those $700 a night tourists or a UN worker gets sick, let's say they contract something endemic to the region, like complex malaria or dengue fever or typhoid, what actually happens?
Right.
Because you can't just dial 911.
No, you can't. The default response is extreme, highly expensive friction. If you get seriously ill in Kabong, you are facing a brutal 10 to 12-hour drive over unpaved, deeply rutted mud and gravel roads just to reach a hospital in the capital, Kampala.
10 to 12 hours in the mud while you're violently ill.
Exactly. And the alternative is to call in an emergency medical charter flight from a local dirt airstrip.
And looking at the business plans we reviewed, those flights are not cheap. They run anywhere between $1,200 and $2,500 a pop.
Yeah, and that is assuming a pilot is even available, and assuming you have daylight, because navigating those remote dirt airstrips at night is often impossible.
Oh, man.
So this logistical nightmare completely breaks the back of corporate insurance policies. Any multinational organization, mining conglomerate, or major NGO operating in this kind of zone four environment pays an absolute fortune in liability and medevac insurance.
Because the risk is just so high.
Right. The premiums are sky high simply because there is no local stabilization or diagnostic capability. The insurance companies know that every minor fever could turn into a $3,000 evacuation.
Which is just a massive bleed on the budget.
Hmm.
And this is where Duraticular's solution, the clinic in a box, enters the chat.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly.
The reports describe this physical asset, and it honestly sounds like a spaceship medical bay dropped into the savannah. If I walk into this thing, what am I actually looking at? Is it just a glorified nurse's station with some aspirin as a stethoscope?
Oh no, not at all. It is essentially a miniaturized, hyper-advanced diagnostic hospital.
Okay.
The chassis is just a standard shipping container, which makes it easy to transport and drop on site. But inside, it is a highly specialized, electromagnetically shielded, air-conditioned module.
Wow.
And crucially, it is completely off-grid. It draws constant, perfectly regulated power from that agroplasma gasification microgrid we mentioned earlier.
Right. Now, why is the power source so important for a clinic? I mean, couldn't they just use a normal diesel generator?
Well, because sensitive medical diagnostic equipment, things that read blood samples at a microscopic level,
yeah,
they cannot handle the voltage spikes and brownouts you typically see on fragile municipal grids or cheap generators in developing nations.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, a single power surge can fry a $100,000 hemology analyzer in a second.
Ouch. So they have completely stable power. What kind of gear are they actually running inside this box?
The spec sheets are incredibly impressive. They have automated hematology and biochemistry analyzers.
What does that mean in practical terms?
It means they can run a complete blood count, a liver function panel, or a renal check in about 15 minutes from a simple finger prick.
So no waiting 3 days for a lab in the capital to process it.
None. You know right away. But the real game changer in the spec sheet is the rapid PCR multiplexing.
Let's break that down for the listener, because PCR multiplexing sounds like a lot of heavy jargon.
Sure. Think of PCR as a highly advanced genetic photocopy machine.
Okay.
If you are sick in the bush, traditional medicine often involves a doctor looking at your symptoms, say you have a high fever and sweating and guessing what you have. Maybe it's malaria, maybe it's typhoid.
Just trial and error.
Right. But with PCR multiplexing, they take a tiny sample of your blood, put it in a machine, and the machine actually looks for the specific DNA or RNA of the bugs causing the illness.
Oh.
Yeah, within 15 minutes, they can definitively prove at a genetic level whether a patient has malaria, typhoid, cholera, or a whole host of other tropical diseases. There's zero guessing.
That's incredible. And they also equip it with handheld point-of-care ultrasound, which they call POCUS, right?
Yes.
And digital otoscopes for looking in ears, and multi-LED ECGs for checking heart rhythms. But this is the part of the report that really blew my mind.
What's that?
Having $250,000 of medical hardware in a shipping container is great, but who is actually reading the results? Like, you can't stick a world-renowned, board-certified radiologist or cardiologist in a box in Uganda year-round. They wouldn't do it, and you couldn't afford them.
No, absolutely not. And this is where the integration of DuraTicular's network architecture really solves the human capital problem. The clinic runs on their edge-native AI system.
Hold on. Edge-native AI. Does that just mean the computer brain is physically inside the shipping container rather than relying on a cloud server somewhere in, like, California?
That is a perfect way to describe it, yeah. In remote environments, you cannot rely on a constant, unbroken internet connection to process critical data.
Right.
So the AI processing happens locally, on the edge of the network, right there inside the box. It pre-analyzes the ultrasounds and the ECGs, flagging anomalies instantly.
But AI isn't a doctor. Like, someone still has to sign off on a diagnosis, especially for insurance purposes, right?
Yes, and for that, they use a Starlink high-performance satellite uplink. When a complex case comes in, or an ECG needs a formal human review to authorize an insurance claim, the local clinician initiates a real-time 4K video consultation with board-certified emergency and internal medicine specialists. And these specialists are sitting in a secure facility in Canada, which the DuraTicular Mesh Network refers to as Node 2.
The synergy there is just incredible. You have local Ugandan clinical officers, people who know the environment and the culture, running the physical point of care, actually holding the ultrasound probe against the patient. And meanwhile, a Canadian specialist is on the screen, looking at the exact same data in real time, confirming the diagnosis. It completely evaporates the geographic isolation.
It really does. And it is that exact capability providing Western-certified, real-time diagnostic proof in the middle of the bush that the commercial operator of Node 1, a company called Cordance Travel and Tourism, realized they could heavily monetize.
So it wasn't originally meant to be a business?
No, the clinic was originally designed just to be an internal cost buffer, a way to keep their own Node 4 engineers safe. But Coordinates looked at the regional healthcare void, looked at all those NGOs and mining companies bleeding money on medevac flights, and turned this asset into a highly lucrative B2B commercial enterprise.
I want to spend some time on how this thing actually makes money, because the revenue engine here is brilliant. They aren't just charging for bandages, they're essentially selling operational peace of mind to major organizations.
Right. They utilize a tiered subscription model, heavily targeting the organizations we discussed earlier.
Let's run through those.
Let's look at the entry level, the silver tier. For $500 a month, a local academic research team or a smaller conservation NGO can cover up to 5 local staff members.
And what do they get for that?
That subscription grants them unlimited basic infectious disease screening and 24/7 emergency stabilization access.
Okay, that's solid. Then you step up to the gold tier, which is $1,500 a month. Why would an organization triple their spend for this?
So this tier targets mid-sized development partners like UNICEF or the World Food Program, who have much larger footprints. It covers up to 15 staff members, but it also includes comprehensive biannual physicals, priority telemedicine bookings with the Canadian doctors.
That's nice.
Yeah, and a very unique logistical perk. If an NGO worker gets sick out in the field, far from the clinic, coordinates can dispatch one of their autonomous electric vehicles, a curb car, for an emergency medical pickup.
Wait, literally a self-driving ambulance in the bush?
Pretty much.
That is wild. And then at the top end, you have the platinum tier for $3,500 a month.
Yeah, this is aimed squarely at the multinational mining corporations operating in the Karamoja mineral belt. It covers 40 personnel.
Okay.
But a mining company needs more than just basic care, right? They need occupational health tracking, pre-employment health screenings to avoid liability, and direct integrated coordination with their global medevac insurance providers. The platinum tier provides that entire administrative backbone.
It's full concierge. But they don't turn away people without a subscription, right?
Yeah.
Like if an independent luxury safari tourist rolls in from a lodge with a spiking fever, they have a pay-per-use menu.
Yeah. The walk-in tariffs are steep, but they are standard for Western medical care. $120 for a rapid PCR screen. $200 for a 12-lead ECG reviewed by a Canadian specialist. $300 for a telehealth consult.
And there's one more revenue stream mentioned in the business plan that I thought was genius. It's a highly strategic flat fee they charge directly to the international insurance companies.
Oh, yes. This is really clever. If a patient is severely injured or ill, and they actually do require an evacuation flight to Kampala, the clinic acts as the regional triage and stabilization hub.
Right.
They charge the insurance underwriter a flat $500 fee just for stabilizing the patient, hooking them up to monitors, and coordinating the flight telemetry with the incoming pilot and the receiving hospital.
And the insurance companies happily pay that $500.
They are thrilled to pay it.
Yeah.
Having accurate real-time medical data from the clinic prevents the insurance company from blindly dispatching a $2,500 emergency aircraft for someone who, you know, it turns out just has a minor, easily treatable stomach bug.
Oh, of course.
The data saves the insurer thousands of dollars per incident, so $500 is a bargain.
Wow. Let's look at the financial synthesis of this operation. The business plan projects year one revenues for the clinic at $138,000.
Right. And when we look at the operational expenditure, or OPEX, which includes the medical regions, the payouts to the Canadian specialists in Node 2, the salaries for the local Ugandan staff, and the Starlink subscription overhead, the total cost to run the clinic for a year is only $48,000.
That is a massive 65% gross margin. They're netting $90,000 a year in local operating income from a single shipping container.
Exactly. And they managed to do this while navigating a massive hurdle in international development, which is legal compliance.
Oh, right. Data privacy.
Major NGOs like the UN or USAI and certainly Western mining companies cannot legally clear their personnel to use a medical facility unless that facility complies with strict data privacy laws. We are talking about HIPAA in the United States and GDPR in Europe.
Because you can't just have sensitive patient data, blood test results, and ultrasounds floating around on an unsecured laptop in the bush. A single hack or lost thumb drive would be a massive lawsuit.
A total disaster. So Dearticular solves this compliance nightmare by using localized data vaults. The patient health records, the imaging files, the telemedicine logs, they are strictly isolated on edge-native database enclaves, physically located inside the clinic itself.
So nothing goes to the cloud.
Right. They are encrypted using advanced cryptographic keys and are never exposed to public cloud servers. This absolute verifiable data sovereignty is what gives the major corporate clients the legal green light from their lawyers to sign those lucrative $3,500 a month retainer contracts.
Okay, I have to stop you here. We have established that this clinic in a box is a highly profitable, high-tech oasis. It solves the bush cap for the wealthy expats, it satisfies the corporate lawyers, and it prints $90,000 a year in profit.
Yep.
But if you are listening to this, you might be feeling a sense of unease, because I certainly am. This sounds incredibly dystopian.
Dystopian? How so?
Think about the optics of this. You are building a walled garden of extreme wealth and technology in a desert of poverty. Mm. You have multinational mining executives and $700 a night eco-tourists sitting in an air-conditioned shipping container getting real-time ultrasounds beamed to Canada. Meanwhile, a mile down the dirt road, the local indigenous population is struggling with basic survival, and their kids are dying from preventable malaria.
Right.
Doesn't dropping a money-making sci-fi hospital into that environment paint a massive target on your back? I mean, aren't the locals just going to look at this alienating symbol of extreme wealth and eventually try to burn it down or at least strip it for parts?
I am really, really glad you brought this up, because your reaction is the exact vulnerability the project planners were terrified of.
Okay, so they knew this.
It is a completely valid pushback. The strategic reports for Project Octagon do not gloss over this. They acknowledge it head on. The documents explicitly state that in areas like Karamoja, the unilateral deployment of high-tech assets by foreign or corporate entities is almost never perceived by the local population as development.
What is it perceived as?
It is perceived as a foreign invasion.
It's the paradox of the enclave. The richer the enclave gets, the more resentment it generates outside the fence.
Precisely. And we have to analyze the specific physical vulnerability of this particular island. The footprint of Project Octagon is massive, and it is highly exposed. We aren't just talking about protecting one shipping container.
Right, there's the whole farm.
Remember, Node 4 is a 7,000-acre industrial hemp estate. You have the AgriDot energy plasma gasification units operating at 1,500 degrees Celsius. These are highly sensitive, incredibly expensive, custom-built pieces of machinery.
You can't just hide a plasma gasification plant. And let's not forget the transit system, the curb cars.
Exactly. The project relies on a fleet of 20 autonomous electric vehicles to handle logistics, transit, and ecotourism. And consider the terrain they operate on.
They are operating on unpaved public dirt tracks, the Murrum roads.
You physically cannot build a fence around a public transit corridor spanning dozens of miles.
You just can't.
These silent, high-tech autonomous vehicles are driving past local homesteads through valleys historically known for severe cattle rustling flare-ups and tribal friction. From a traditional security standpoint, they are absolute sitting ducks.
Right. If I'm a local cattle rustler who feels marginalized by this massive corporate project, throwing a rock through the windshield of an autonomous vehicle that has no driver inside to defend it seems like pretty low-hanging fruit.
It's an incredibly easy target.
So how do traditional infrastructure projects in Africa handle this kind of exposure? Because mines and oil pipelines have been operating in hostile or complex environments for decades.
The legacy approach to infrastructure protection is entirely kinetic and militarized. It relies on brute force and hardened physical barriers.
What we were saying before.
Yeah. You build a massive cinder block wall, you install high-cost surveillance camera networks, and you hire private security firms to run armed patrol loops around your assets 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You essentially build a prison where you lock yourselves inside.
Yes. And the Duraticula reports analyze this legacy model deeply, outlining two massive fatal flaws with it. First, the financial bleed. Running a traditional armed guard and hardened perimeter model for a footprint the size of Node 4 costs roughly $5,000 a month in pure operational expenditure.
Which eats into your margins incredibly fast. $60,000 a year just to maintain the status quo.
But the second failure is far more dangerous, and it addresses your earlier point, the social cost. Mm. Armed guards, attack dogs, and razor wire actively alienate the local population.
Yeah, it sends a terrible message.
It manufactures intense social friction where none might have existed before. A fence fundamentally tells the community, this wealth is ours, we do not trust you, and you are kept out.
And what happens when you tell a historically marginalized community they are kept out of a massive wealth-generating project built on their ancestral land?
It inevitably leads to escalated regional tensions. The reports note that traditional security models in these environments suffer from a constant bleeding baseline of sabotage.
Like what?
You get constant fence cutting, localized vandalism, and opportunistic asset theft. The local population feels absolutely no ownership or benefit from the project. Therefore, they have zero incentive to protect it and every economic incentive to extract value from it by force, theft, or extortion.
So you end up paying $5,000 a month not to achieve security, but simply to manage a hostile relationship.
Exactly.
So I want you, the listener, to really visualize this exact scenario. You are the operational director of Node One. You have a self-driving, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar curb car ferrying VIP investors down a public dirt road at dusk. There is no driver inside to defend it. You cannot build a wall around a public road. A group of disenfranchised youth or local cattle rustler sees this vehicle approaching. How do you stop them from destroying it?
This is where Dereticular engineers a radically different borderline genius solution. They looked at the data and realized that traditional security inevitably fails and costs a fortune. So they decided to completely reframe the paradigm.
Okay, what do they do?
They decided to treat physical security not as a military or engineering problem, but as a socioeconomic and public health equation.
This brings us to the absolute core of the entire operation, the concept they call the dual-use model. Forging the goodwill moat.
Yes. Let's trace the money back. Remember that $90,000 of net operating income we calculated earlier.
The profit generated from charging the NGOs, the luxury tourists, and the mining companies top dollar for premium medical care. The B2B revenue engine. The capitalist side of the clinic.
Right. Coordinates Travel and Tourism does not just pocket that surplus and pay it out as dividends. It is systematically weaponized as a security offset.
Oh, wow.
They take the high-margin corporate revenue and use it to cross-subsidize free, world-class community clinics for the local indigenous populations, specifically the Karamojong pastoralists and the Ike mountain tribes.
Okay, let's compare the balance sheets on this, because the economics of goodwill are fascinating when you break them down.
Let's review the traditional model first. Hardened fences, private security contractors, high-cost armed patrol loops. As we established, that costs about $5,000 a month.
Right.
And the yield on that investment is high friction, deep resentment, and a constant baseline rate of fence cutting and sabotage.
Now look at the dual-use clinical model.
The cost to run the community health program, which means paying for the malaria, rapid test reagents, the ultrasound gel, the basic antibiotics, and the shared hours of the local Ugandan nursing staff during the community shifts, comes out to roughly $1,500 a month.
Okay.
Add to that a $500 a month community fund, which is allocated directly to the local tribal elders for translation services and transport logistics.
So you are spending $2,000 a month total. That is less than half the cost of the armed guards.
And the yield on that $2,000 investment, the project documents a 0% sabotage rate across its unpaved transit corridors and unfenced assets.
Wait, really? 0%?
Zero.
That is wild. No broken windshields, no cut power lines. Why? What is the actual psychological deterrent at play here? Because it isn't just people deciding to be nice to a corporation.
It is deeply pragmatic behavioral economics. By providing free, highly advanced healthcare, specifically targeting the two most critical vulnerabilities in the region, which are pediatric care and maternal diagnostics, the entire dereticular ecosystem integrates into the very social fabric of Karamoja.
It ceases to be an invading corporate enclave.
Exactly. It becomes an absolute, indispensable lifeline for the local population.
If we connect this back to that scenario on the dirt road, think about what this means for a local warrior considering sabotaging a curb car or cutting a wire on the agri-microgrid to steal some copper.
The psychological shift is profound and instantaneous. If you damage the microgrid, you aren't just hurting a faceless tech corporation or delaying a UN supply run. You are literally cutting the power to the exact machine, the clinic in a box, that definitively diagnoses and cures your own child's malaria. You are shutting down the ultrasound machine that caught the dangerous breech positioning in your pregnant sister just last week.
So the local herders, the community themselves, become the active defenders of the perimeter. They become the security force. Because protecting the infrastructure is completely synonymous with protecting their own families.
It creates a symbiotic dependency. The community desperately needs the clinic to survive the endemic health threats of the region, and the project desperately needs the community's goodwill to survive the physical vulnerabilities of operating on the frontier. A physical fence tells people to stay away, but a goodwill moat binds their survival to your success.
That is incredible. It's security through aggressive empathy, but I have to play devil's advocate again here.
Sure, go ahead.
Having a great, elegant concept on a whiteboard in a boardroom is one thing. Executing it in reality, out in the dust and the heat, without causing cultural offense or operational chaos, requires incredibly deep, localized precision.
It's extremely difficult, yes.
I mean, how exactly does Node 1 manage to serve global, high-paying NGOs expecting a premium experience and traditional nomadic pastoralists out of the exact same shipping container?
That is the operational tightrope they have to walk. If you try to run this clinic as a 24/7 free-for-all, clinical standards will inevitably drop.
Right.
The VIP paying clients who fund the entire operation will get alienated by crowded, chaotic waiting rooms. They will cancel their subscriptions, and the high-margin revenue engine that subsidizes the community care will collapse.
It's like trying to run a 5-star luxury hotel that is also a public homeless shelter and trying to keep both groups happy in the same lobby. It sounds impossible.
To manage this friction, Node 1 implements what they call a strict resource partitioning protocol. They utilize temporal partitioning, meaning they divide the schedule very rigidly to serve different demographics at different times.
Let's break that schedule down. How does it actually work week to week?
Monday through Friday, from 8:00 a.m. to 5:00 p.m., the clinic operates in strict industrial hours.
Okay, standard business hours.
Yes. This massive time block is exclusively reserved for the Node 4 industrial workforce, visiting VIP investors, and the premium NGO retainer clients. This ensures the Western standard, quiet, highly attentive clinical environment that the high-paying clients expect for their $3,500 a month.
And the community, when do they get access to the facility?
The community off-hours are strictly scheduled for Tuesdays and Thursdays from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. and Saturdays from 8:00 a.m. to 2:00 p.m.
Now, if you are listening to this, you might be thinking, wow, that's incredibly restrictive. Why only evenings and a Saturday morning? That doesn't sound like a standard hospital schedule.
Right. But what is fascinating here and what the source documents really emphasize is the cultural brilliance of that specific timing. You have to understand who the primary local population is.
The Karamojong.
Exactly. The Karamojong are traditional semi-nomadic pastoralists. Their daily lives, their entire economy revolves entirely around their cattle. During the day, from sunrise to late afternoon, the men, the youth, and often the women are out grazing the herds over vast arid distances.
So if you, as a well-meaning Western NGO, open your free clinic at noon on a Wednesday, the locals literally cannot come without abandoning their herds, which means abandoning their livelihood.
Precisely. It would force them to choose between their economic survival and their health. By scheduling the community windows in the late afternoon and early evening, the clinic perfectly aligns with their existing centuries-old herding patterns.
That's so smart.
It allows the pastoralists to bring their wives, their sick children, and their elders into the clinic after the cattle have been safely watered and penned for the night. It shows a deep structural respect for their economic reality.
It isn't just saying, here is free healthcare, take it or leave it.
Mm.
It is saying, here is free healthcare designed from the ground up to actually fit into the reality of your daily life.
And this deliberate effort to bridge the cultural divide extends deeply into the staffing model as well. When the clock strikes 5:30 p.m. on a Tuesday and the clinic shifts into community off hours, the clinical dynamic inside the box changes completely. The point-of-care diagnostics are handed over to local Ugandan clinical officers and nurses who are specifically hired from the surrounding region.
Why is that shift in personnel so important? The Canadian doctors are still on the video feed, right?
The Canadian doctors are in the background for complex reviews, yes. But the primary face-to-face interface changes. The local nurses speak the local dialects, specifically Ngakarimanong and Aistat.
Okay, that changes everything.
Imagine a traditional mother bringing in a feverish, crying child to a high-tech metal box humming with electricity. It is terrifying.
Totally.
But she is immediately greeted by a medical professional who understands her language, understands her traditional beliefs about illness, and can explain the technology to her in a way that makes sense. It makes the patients feel comfortable and respected rather than intimidated and alienated by foreign tech.
The reports also talk a lot about the traditional power structures of the tribes.
Yeah.
Because anyone who has studied international development knows you can't just bypass the local leaders and start handing out resources directly to the people, right? That can cause its own kind of massive social friction.
Absolutely. Bypassing local elders or traditional chiefs is a classic arrogant mistake made by many well-intentioned Western development projects, and it almost always leads to backlash.
Yeah.
To ensure the traditional power structures are respected and maintained, the Node One Project coordinates all community outreach directly with the Karamojong Council of Elders and the tribal chiefs of the Aikuk people.
And this is where that $500 community fund you mentioned earlier comes into play.
Yes. The operational leader of Node One on the ground, a man named Mike Tumisiki, physically managed this fund. It is granted directly to the elders to handle translation logistics and to coordinate the physical transport of elderly or severely ill patients from distant, hard-to-reach villages to the clinic.
So they put the resources directly in the elders' hands.
Exactly. It empowers the elders to be the providers of this immense benefit to their people, reinforcing their status rather than undermining it.
The reports mention a detail that I absolutely loved. They note that before the clinic even opened to the public, the local elders literally came out and performed a traditional blessing on the big box, the shipping container itself, upon its installation.
That symbolic act is crucial to the security model. By formally blessing it, the elders actively integrated the high-tech installation into the community's cultural and spiritual landscape. It transformed it from a strange, intrusive, alien object into a respected, protected community sanctuary.
Okay, so we have the culturally aligned schedule, we have the local staff speaking the dialects, we have the blessing and coordination of the elders. What is the actual medical care being delivered during these off hours? Because even with all this tech, they can't do everything, right? It isn't a full general surgical hospital.
Correct. The strategy relies on high-impact, edge-native triage. They don't try to treat everything. They focus their advanced technology on the most critical, devastating local health threats. First and foremost, they utilize that 15-minute rapid PCR multiplexing we discussed.
The genetic screening machine.
Yes. Malaria is highly endemic in the swampy valleys of Karamoja, especially during the rainy season, and delayed diagnosis is a leading cause of child mortality in the region.
Which is tragic.
By providing definitive 15-minute genetic proof of malaria or typhoid, the clinic can immediately dispense targeted, life-saving anti-malarial medications or antibiotics on site. This dramatically reduces child mortality in the immediate vicinity of the industrial park.
They also heavily prioritize maternal health care, which I imagine is a massive issue in a region with no paved roads.
Oh, it's huge. Maternal mortality in Karamoja is among the highest in all of East Africa, largely due to a total lack of basic prenatal screening.
Right.
So during the Saturday community windows, the clinic heavily prioritizes pregnant women using the handheld point-of-care ultrasound, or POCUS.
So a local clinician scans the pregnant mother. And if something looks wrong, that image is beamed up via the Starlink satellite to a specialist in Canada.
Exactly. They can catch high-risk presentations, early things like breech positioning, placenta previa, or multiple gestations, which can be a death sentence if they happen during a traditional birth in a remote village.
Oh, absolutely.
If a high-risk pregnancy is identified by the ultrasound, the clinic coordinates with regional ambulance services or NGOs to safely move the mother to a secondary surgical facility in a larger town well before the actual labor begins and complications arise.
The reports also mention trauma care being a big focus, which makes perfect sense when you think about it.
Yeah.
Gold mining and cattle herding are not exactly safe desk jobs.
No, they are intensely physically hazardous livelihoods. The clinic provides rapid wound care, clean suturing, tetanus immunizations, and point-of-care imaging to check for bone fractures or internal injuries sustained from artisanal mining accidents or violent herding incidents.
Just keeping people functional.
Right. By treating these injuries quickly and cleanly, they prevent minor cuts from turning into systemic, life-threatening infections, and they prevent broken bones from causing long-term physical disability, which preserves the stability and productivity of the local labor force.
Yeah, I want to circle back to something we touched on earlier, because the physical logistics of this are genuinely mind-blowing. We talked about the Ik people. They're a mountain tribe, right? They live high up on Mount Morungal, far away from the valley floor.
Yes.
How do they actually access a clinic sitting down in the valley next to a hemp farm?
This is perhaps the most elegant, seamless integration of the entire Node One ecosystem. It is a protocol they call a sovereign supply chain of care, and it involves the curb cars.
The autonomous electric vehicles that we worried were going to get rocks thrown at them.
Yes. Remember that Coordinates Travel, the company running the clinic, also operates luxury adventure tourism. This includes guided, high-end cultural treks up Mount Morungal for wealthy tourists to visit the isolated Ik villages. To reach the base of the mountain, these tourists are driven in the autonomous curb cars.
Okay, I think I see where this is going, and it is brilliant.
So rather than having the curb cars return to the base empty after dropping off the tourists at the trailhead, the project coordinates heavily with the exachiefs. When the vehicles head back down the mountain to the Node 1 campus, they physically transport pregnant Ik women, the elderly, or the sick, down to the clinic in a box for free diagnostics.
Wow, so the high-paying eco-tourists literally subsidize the vehicle's trip up the mountain, and then the exact same autonomous vehicle acts as a free, high-tech medical shuttle for the indigenous population on the way down.
It is a fully closed, autonomous loop of community care. The exact same infrastructure that generates the profit delivers the philanthropy, and in doing so, it mathematically secures its own operational safety.
It is an absolute masterclass in behavioral economics, system design, and just plain human empathy. Let's try to summarize this incredible journey for the listener, because we have covered a massive amount of ground today.
We really have.
If you take away anything from this deep dive, it's that Node 1 isn't just a tech showcase. It isn't just about plasma gasification or edge-native AI or satellite uplinks in shipping containers.
No, at its absolute core, Node 1 is an elegant, highly engineered solution to human vulnerability in a harsh, unforgiving environment. The planners identified a massive logistical barrier, the bush gap, the total lack of healthcare that prevents investment and spikes insurance.
Right.
They solved it by deploying a high-tech clinic in a box.
And by creating a high-margin commercial medical service out of that clinic, serving the UN NGOs and the mining executives, they generated the localized capital they needed to survive.
But the true paradigm-shifting innovation is the second loop. They took that capitalist revenue, that $90,000 of profit, and weaponized it to provide free, culturally integrated, life-saving healthcare to the local Karmajong and Ikt communities.
By providing that local healthcare on a schedule that respected the community and using local languages, they aligned the survival of the indigenous community with the survival of the industrial park. They secured a 7,000-acre infrastructure grid and a fleet of autonomous vehicles operating on public dirt roads, infinitely better than an army of armed guards ever could. They built the goodwill moat.
It completely upends the traditional narrative of corporate development in Africa. It proves that technology, when deployed with deep cultural empathy and smart economic cross-subsidization, doesn't have to be an alienating, destructive force. It can be the very thing that weaves a fractured community together and provides absolute security.
Which brings me to a final provocative thought. I really want to leave you, the listener, with something to ponder long after this deep dive ends. We just spent the last hour exploring how a decentralized AI consortium managed to perfectly protect a multi-million-dollar, highly vulnerable asset in the harsh, unpredictable African bush.
Yeah.
And they did it using nothing but ultrasound machines, rapid malaria tests, and a culturally aware schedule.
They achieved perfect physical security without erecting a single razor wire fence or hiring a single armed guard.
Exactly. So what does that say about us? What does that say about how we handle security, community integration, and corporate responsibility in our own modern, highly developed urban cities?
That's a great question.
When we drive around and see corporate campuses, gated communities, and industrial parks in our own neighborhoods, completely surrounded by high iron fences, security cameras, and armed patrols, are those fences actually a sign of security? Or are they just a glaring symptom of a completely failed relationship with the community outside the wall? Think about it. We will catch you on the next deep dive.